ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The amphibian Rana sylvatica is definitely the coolest animal on the planet, hands down. At a certain time of the year, I should add. It's not that these Canadian wood frogs have some kind of animal charisma, or even that they have a striking or unusual appearance. But there's one thing they can do that leaves other animals for dead. When it gets too cold, and we're talking about Canada, remember, so we're talking really cold. Well, when it gets really cold, they can turn themselves into ice. Professor of Biochemistry, Ken Story.
Wood frogs can't induce freezing unless they're below zero. But once they're below zero, they have nucleating substances. The nucleation you may have heard about in making it rain. You nucleate clouds with iodide crystals, water gathers around the crystals, and then rain forms. There wouldn't be rain without the crystals. So what the frog has is nucleating proteins that induce ice to form at high sub-zero temperatures. So at 0 degrees, no ice, frog is fine, just sitting there. Once it gets below zero, the frog induces ice formation on the outside, on the skin, and then the ice flows into the frog. It races from the skin into the frog using veins and arteries. Those veins and arteries fill with ice and are conduits, they're tubes, and they push all the blood in front of it. As this happens at high sub-zero temperatures, the heart's still beating, but once the ice reaches it, they're frozen. So my animals cryopreserve and they're hard and crunchy and filled with ice. So they're hard like a green colored ice cube, and this preserves their life for the entire winter. This isn't ice in a cube around the frog. This is the frog becoming the cube.
How's that for a party trick? Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Welcome to Future Tense. The power of a good chill for medicine and for future-proofing endangered species. It's called cryopreservation, and it's our topic today. Shortly, we'll hear about the work of the Frozen Zoo in California, and we'll find out why the controversial practice of cryogenics, freezing people's bodies after they've died in the hope of one day returning them to life, well, why that's never likely to be successful. But let's stay with frozen frogs and how exactly their bodies managed to survive the winter deep freeze.
They could be magic, but instead they've done a number of things in preparation for freezing. So what the frogs do is fill their cells, every cell, their nuclei, their cells, every organ with glucose, just regular old glucose. You eat it all the time. This glucose then roars out into the blood and stays in the cell. Glucose can't be frozen, so less ice forms, less ice grows, and the cells stay fatter and happier because the glucose is in the cells and can't be stripped out. The animals also change their metabolism over to make glucose. So you have maybe 5 millimolar glucose in your blood. Frogs have 400 millimoles of glucose in their blood. So they can make huge amounts of glucose because in the fall, they've eaten huge amounts of food and stored it as glycogen. They have more stored glucose than you do. They can release that glucose at will. They can fill themselves up with glucose. Not only do their cells not break, but they don't suffer any damage like a diabetic human does from high glucose.
And even though the Canadian frogs are frozen and apparently lifeless, says Professor Story, they never completely switch off.
They change the type of small molecules in the cell so that they can keep running at a very low pilot light. So when you look at a frog, you think it's totally frozen, and it is filled with ice, but it still has a very low level of metabolism that's allowed at minus five, at below zero. One of the things their brain does in order to turn off is they make a molecule called microRNA. They actually make dozens of different kinds of microRNA. And this microRNA allows their brain to survive freezing, then to survive thawing, and then to regrow neurons after freezing. So during freezing, the neurons pull back along axonal tracks. And then after freezing, microRNA allows them to expand back.
In summary then, I think it's safe to say that Rana sylvatica is a pretty impressive animal. And apparently several other frog species can also perform the same trick. Now, Professor Story's interest isn't just in the amphibians themselves. It's actually in the potential they hold for human organ transplants.
If you look at 20 years ago, people were going, oh, we've got to freeze organs at liquid nitrogen temperatures. We've got to put them in dry ice at minus 80 because then they'll be cryopreserved. What the frog says is, hell no, I'm perfectly cryopreserved at minus 3 degrees. So high sub-zero temperature freezing of organs like dogs and cats and mice have worked really well. These organs have been cryopreserved. Their biological lifetime has been extended 10, 50 times. And the next stage is to get medical scientists to take this high sub-zero freezing, add sugar and high sub-zero temperature, and gently freeze human organs, liver, heart, and then the freezing isn't so terrible that it grows too much ice. There's a group in Harvard that does that now, where they're pursuing this. There's also some small companies that are trying this. They're trying to freeze human skin and other organs at high sub-zero temperatures and then use them in the operating room.
So the way you explained it sounds simple. How difficult is it, though, to try, or will it be, to try and use the approach adopted by this frog with human organs and with human tissue?
Well, first, with frogs, we go and catch frogs in the spring. In a small pond here, there will be literally 1,000 Rana sylvatica, and you can scoop up frogs and study them. With studying human organs, I would have to have maybe a dozen control babies and then a dozen experimental babies and freeze them. Oh, wait, we're not allowed to do that. So the problems are practical. The problems are getting enough human organs in good enough shape to do the experiments. You are not allowed just to listen to some guy that freezes frogs in Canada and go into the clinic and begin to freeze your friends. So medical science works slowly, but it does work. And clever ideas don't always translate immediately. Things move slowly for protective reasons. There's nothing we can do about it. And I assure you, things are well on their way.
The amazing thing about these frogs is they actually produce in their bodies sort of an antifreeze. So the way they produce it, it's already inside their cells, so you don't have the challenge of delivering it.
Researcher Saffron Bryant from RMIT University in Melbourne.
We can't just inject a person, for example, with the same chemical because there's a delivery challenge of then getting that chemical into all of the cells in the body at the same time. So the frog has this evolutionary advantage of being able to produce its own antifreeze intracellularly, as well as some of the other physical adaptations that it has in terms of slowing down its metabolic rate and things like that.
Where do you see the field going in future? I mean, how much research is being put into trying to increase, you know, our powers to cryopreserve?
It's an active area of research because of the benefits it could provide if we can manage the organ preservation. So if we could achieve organ preservation, then we could actually eliminate organ waiting lists, which would be obviously like phenomenal for so many people world over. So I think that that's a really active area, but it's also quite a long way away. So until we can store all the different cell types in a heart, for example, which is made up of lots of different types of cells, we won't be able to even think about storing the whole organ.
And again, it's the diversity of cells mm-hmm. in any kind of organism. That's the real stumbling block in a lot of ways, isn't it?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So different cells, they're different sizes, If they're really small, then the whole cell will heat up or cool down sort of really quickly. But large cells, you have a much longer time and it's harder to do it all uniformly. And then different cell types are also, they have different permeability. So that's how well they can sort of take chemicals in. So when we're talking about those antifreeze chemicals that we need to include, some cells will allow certain antifreezes in while others won't. And they do it at different rates. So trying to make sure that you have delivery of this antifreeze to all cell types at the same concentration is one of the major challenges here.
And I presume you've got to look out for toxicity levels.
Definitely. So one of the main cryoprotectants that's used at the moment is dimethyl sulfoxide, which, I mean, probably just from the name, it doesn't sound particularly friendly. And indeed, it can be quite toxic. So when it's used for blood products or stem cells, for example, it has to be washed out before those are given to people. But it also means that if you were to try to soak an organ in the dimethyl sulfoxide, for example, the outer layers are exposed straight away and they start having toxic effects, whereas the inner layers haven't seen any of it. So again, that comes to that uniform distribution that I mentioned.
It's a balancing act then, in terms of with each species that you're trying to preserve, trying to get that mix right.
Yeah, exactly. So even just looking at individual cell types, we have to use different cryoprotectants at different concentrations, add them at different temperatures for different lengths of time. It's a massive space that requires a lot of optimization just for individual cell types, let alone trying to look at storing multiple cell types at once as you would in a tissue or an organ.
So by now, the difficulties of successfully cryopreserving a whole human body, well, need I say more? The problem with cryogenics, though, is that it's currently being offered as a service to people in various Western countries, including Australia. And vulnerable people are paying very large sums of money to have their bodies snap frozen after death. Saffron Bryant again.
So it's almost a two-pronged problem. So you've got the challenge that we can't actually cryopreserve whole organs or whole people, but you've also got the challenge that whatever killed them still killed them. Do you know what I mean? So the cryopreservation aspect can't solve the cancer or whatever it was that killed them in the first place.
It's one thing to try and preserve cells, but we don't actually have a very good idea of memory and consciousness, do we?
Exactly. And I mean, that's a whole other challenge, isn't it? How memory and what makes a personality and all those sort of questions.
So even if you could bring someone back at some stage, it's still a question mark as to whether that person would be the same person, whether they would have the same memories, the same feelings that they had when they were initially frozen.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if we could overcome all the other challenges, then yeah, is enough of that nervous system or whatever makes that person them still there.
Why is it so persistent then as an idea?
I mean, I think it, on a base level, it appeals to people's idea of immortality. You know, everyone is afraid of death. And if there's a way that you can be frozen and then come back in the future, then I think that probably appeals to people's base instincts.
Dr. Saffron Bryant, an expert in cryopreservation from RMIT University. So cryogenics is realistically likely to remain more science fiction than science fact. But there is one speculative human activity where Ken Story's research into wood frogs and other hibernating animals might, and let's emphasise that word might, well, might offer beneficial results one day in the far-off future.
What you can do for interstellar travel is cool down humans. So for me, in interstellar travel, yeah, they're whole humans, but I think that cold will be enough as soon as we learn to turn off their brain patterns. So for space travel, I would look at ground squirrels and bears. They hibernate all winter and they last perfectly well. They've turned down their fires of life. They're at a very low ebb. So for me, cold works with mammals. We work with dozens of kind of mammals that can lower their metabolic rate. And if you do it in the cold, you learn about what changes. We can then take those changes and turn organs off. So right now, we know all of the molecules that change in all of the tissues of ground squirrels. We take that, we put it into human cells or human organs, and we can turn those off for extended periods of time. Ice is dangerous to work with. It can't go too low, even in a frog. If you freeze a frog at minus 20, it's going to die. There's just too much ice for glucose to fight. But if you've got glucose, if you've got microRNA, then you can fight the cold almost indefinitely. So my money is on cold astronauts, but it makes for a very boring Star Trek movie.
Ken Story, a professor of biology and biochemistry at Carleton University. And you're listening to Future Tense on ABC Radio National. I'm Anthony Fennell.
San Diego Zoo Global is uniquely qualified to lead the fight against extinction. Our frozen zoo is the world's largest repository of living animal cells, and our seed bank stores more than 500...
My name is Marlis Houck, and I'm the curator of the frozen zoo. So the frozen zoo is the largest, most diverse collection of its kind. And what I mean by its kind is we have living samples that fall into two categories. They are the gametes, which is the sperm and ova, which are eggs, embryos and reproductive tissues. And we also have skin cells. And these are living materials from currently over 11,300 individuals. And they represent over 1,320 species and subspecies. And these are vertebrates. They are birds, mammals, amphibians, reptiles, and fish. So it's quite a remarkable collection, and it's grown to that size in part because it was started in 1975.
And underpinning all of this is the same principle that underpins seed banks, isn't it? It's the preservation of genetic diversity.
Yes, exactly. We can be compared to a seed bank very correctly, yes.
What species have you prioritized so far?
So in the beginning, they were collecting anything, because if you think about it, anything they collected was basically a new species to the frozen zoo. But we are focusing on diversity. We want to represent as many species as we can. We are concerned with any species that are in decline, rare and endangered, or rapidly declining. But we do collect almost everything because we do share the cells with other researchers who are qualified. And the requests come in for all sorts of species, including domestic animals.
Why is this approach necessary? Why not rely on trying to preserve animals in the wild? Is this simply a reflection of how many animals are endangered in the current climate?
Well, of course, ideally we would rather preserve animals in their natural habitat. The frozen zoo collection started for internal in-house research on chromosomes. Dr. Kurt Benerschke, he was studying the chromosomes of all these various different species, only mammals at the time. And he needed living dividing cells to look at these chromosomes. And what they were learning was just fascinating, that the chromosomes ranged from 6 in a muntjac to 84 in a black rhinoceros. And then from that, he said, you know, we need to bank these cells because we don't know what they might be used for in the future. And so to have them banked, we're banking the genetic diversity. And so that's how the frozen zoo began. So yes, we want to save the animals in their environment, but having this collection, what it turns out is because they were collecting cells on everything back then, including, for one example, the northern white rhino. There were probably at the time over 100 northern white rhino individuals. That sounds like a small number, but today there are only 2 left. And they're functionally extinct because they're both females and they're non-reproductive. But because they had banked cells in the beginning, not necessarily anticipating that the northern white rhino would have such a decline, we now have the cells of 12 northern white rhinos in the frozen zoo. And those cells contain the genetic diversity of all of those individuals and could be used to help bring the species back from the brink of extinction.
And combined with cloning technology, you have had success in bringing back some species, haven't you?
Yes. One example is the Przewalski's horse, and another is the black-footed ferret. And in both of those cases, there have been clones made from the cells that were banked in the frozen zoo. And the cells were banked in the 80s, so it's pretty remarkable that you can think that what the lab techs were banking in the 80s, you fast forward to current times, and those cells are being used to bring back the genetic diversity that would have otherwise been lost. And our collaborators at Revive and Restore and Viagen, they do the cloning, but without the cells in the frozen zoo, this would not be possible.
Looking forward, what's the preservation limit in terms of the usefulness of cells? Do we know that?
So as far as we know, the cells should remain viable indefinitely. We preserve them with a cryoprotectant called dimethyl sulfoxide, and that prevents the ice crystals from being formed as they're frozen. And if the ice crystals formed, they would break the cell membrane and cause cell death. But as long as you have a cryoprotectant, it's kind of like an antifreeze. It does like a soft freeze, and it puts them into a state where they are no longer metabolizing, so they're not degrading. And we should be able to pull these cells out, if properly stored all these years, and pull out a vial of cells. And it looks like just the tiniest little ice pellet in the bottom. And we can put it in a water bath for just about 5 minutes and then put that into a flask. And the cells attach to the bottom of the flask and begin growing again. And in each one of those vials, there are about 1 to 3 million living cells.
What's the success rate with the different types of animal cells that you have frozen?
We establish the cells here in the lab. We get a small piece of skin. It's always opportunistic, either after an animal dies or if a veterinarian is taking a sample and they are requesting us to bank the cells for a particular reason. But we start with this small biopsy and we establish the cells here. And we have a different success rate for the different groups of species. It began with mammals, and we're quite good with mammals. We have a very small team of technicians who are highly trained to grow these cells. It's a very unique specialty. But the success rate is about 98, 99% with mammals, about the same with birds. And then it reduces a little bit for reptiles. And then amphibians are where we struggle. It's historically been a difficult group of animals for any cell culturist to grow. And we've made quite a bit of improvements. And we're happy to say that we have over 100 individuals frozen. And I think we're at about at least 20 species of amphibians. But the success rate among the amphibians for us is still probably only about 25%.
And why is that?
We don't know yet. They're definitely challenging. Any animal that lives in the water naturally has more bacteria on their skin. And so when you're trying to culture cells, you could also culture bacteria or fungus or other contaminants. So we're battling the bacteria and the fungus, but things that kill the bacteria and fungus could also kill the cells. So there's a careful balance there. And then we have to figure out what the right temperature to incubate the cells at. And we need to figure out what media they grow in best, their growth media. So we're still experimenting with all of those. And I think we and people around the world haven't quite yet come upon the perfect solution and the optimal conditions for amphibians.
Marlis Hauck from the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance. Now, the Frozen Zoo is one of the biggest and longest operating cryopreservation facilities in the world, as we've just heard. But others have also been established in recent years in countries including Australia.
Hi, I'm Justine O'Brien. I'm the Conservation Science Manager at Taronga. And right now I'm just out of Townsville in northern Queensland, adjacent to the Central Great Barrier Reef, where we're at the Australian Institute of Marine Science getting ready for the coral spawning season.
The Taronga Conservation Society Australia is attached to the famous Sydney Zoo, and it operates three biobanks. It's not a closed network, it's very much focused on cooperation.
One of the most powerful tools we have in conservation is collaboration. And with the example of the Reef Restoration and Adaptation Program that we collaborate on, we've got universities, zoos like Taronga, there's traditional custodians of the Great Barrier Reef, there's many different universities and federal government organisations like the CSIRO. So yeah, it really is dependent on that collaboration. And in the sense or in the context of biobanking, we do have some national strategies at play. One of them is the Zoo and Aquarium Association's Wildlife Biobank Working Group. And this is a group that will develop a framework for managing a network of accessible biobanks in the Australian and the New Zealand context. And it will include guidance on operational aspects, on ethical aspects and legal aspects of biobanks.
The Taronga facilities currently hold samples from around 90 species, including 32 identified coral species.
We start at the point of saying, well, where can we add the most value? So what do our experts and our staff have experience in? Another really important element is what do we know about that species' reproductive biology and their general physiology? We need that information in order to not only collect the samples and learn how to preserve them, but we also need that information to use them down the track. We do have quite a lot of expertise, I guess, in mammal and bird conservation breeding programs. And when we are integrated into those conservation efforts where our practitioners, our conservation practitioners, are actually managing the wild populations as well. That's where we see our biobanks as having the biggest value. So we're integrating our sample collection and cryopreservation procedures with the recovery of those populations in the wild.
Tell us about the work that you do with reef restoration using cryopreservation.
The reef restoration program, we've got a team that have been going to the Great Barrier Reef each year since 2011 and started with the Smithsonian Institution in the US. And that program has continued since that time. Our key scientist leading that program is John Daly at Taronga, and we have broadened that program to include sperm cryopreservation efforts along with other cell types. And we are integrating all those procedures into reef restoration efforts as part of the Australian government's reef restoration and adaptation program. And I will add to that that there are many different organisations involved in that program, in that initiative, and that's run in collaboration with the Australian Institute of Marine Science. We're here for the coral spawning season, and we're involved in that program with the Great Barrier Reef Foundation as well. So that's a massive initiative. There's, I believe, 100 scientists working on the program. There's global interest in all the intervention tools that we're developing here because it will set the stage for coral reef restoration efforts across the world.
And the benefit of cryopreservation when you're working to regenerate coral species, is it that you can do that outside of the traditional spawning season? Is that the major benefit?
Yes, yes. Look, this is the major benefit. And we're not talking so much about sperm in this sense, but being able to cryopreserve coral larvae, so analogous to early embryos for mammals, this would potentially enable us to put new corals back onto the reef throughout the year, so any time of the year, rather than only following that brief annual spawning season in the late spring or early summer.
And a broad question, I mean, what future potential do you see for cryopreservation?
Oh, look, there's huge, huge potential. The types of technologies that we imagine now will be far different and may bring many, many different benefits to wildlife than we can possibly imagine. You know, cryopreservation technologies as a whole, like other reproductive technologies, have advanced rapidly in the past 5 to 10 years. And when I first started out in this area, we were examining the reproductive biology of threatened rhino species. And, you know, 20 years or so later, and we're putting rhino calves on the ground, so to speak, at a rate that we could not have envisaged previously. So one of the key things that will be in translating that science from the laboratory research to application at a scale enough to support entire ecosystems is where we want to be. So that's a massive potential for cryopreservation. And again, just coming back to that lack of knowledge now that we have around what potential technologies will be developed in the future. If we don't have those cells collected and biobanked, there's no way we'll be able to use those future technologies. It's quite a binary scenario there. And so we're aiming to conserve as much biodiversity as we can now so we can support those future conservation technologies and all the benefits that they will bring to wildlife in the future.
Justine O'Brien from the Taronga Conservation Society Australia. We also heard today from Marlis Houck at the Frozen Zoo in San Diego, Ken Story of Carleton University in Ottawa, and Saffron Brines from RMIT University in Melbourne. Karen Savanovitz is my co-producer here at Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time, cheers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.